Today, accelerator or brake? The DFA Daily is the 27th of May 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's news digest, we consider the latest on the economy, construction data, and the fate of Airbnb. And the question is, have we turned an economic corner, or are we still falling? Well, the ANZ Roy Morgan Australian Consumer Confidence Index rose 0.4% to 92.7 in the week, the 24th of May, and that's its eighth straight increase. However, it has a long way to go to return to normal levels, and confidence is up 0.4% and 42% from its low point in March, when fears about the pandemic were at the most extreme. But it is still well below the normal level, and the optimistic positive move in percentage terms is misleading. As a result, we're still around 15% below the confidence level in February, which in itself was not flash. Financial conditions indices diverged, with current finances declining 1.8%, while future finances gained 3.2% and is now only a touch below the average. Economic conditions indices also diverged, with current economic conditions gaining 0.3%, while future economic conditions declined 2.4%, and the time to buy a major household item strengthened further, up 2.5%. The four-week moving average for inflation expectations declined 0.1 percentage point to 3.3%, and that's a new historic low. The ANZ head of Australian economics, David Plank, said confidence strengthened further last week, albeit modestly. While still below average, sentiment has recovered strongly from its March low and is now only around 15% below its level at the end of February. Government measures and signs that the job market is stabilising seem to be playing a key part in the recovery of the index, despite recent concerns over trade with China and weak retail sales. These factors and the move in Australian credit ratings negative outlook by Fitch may explain why expectations about the future economic outlook fell. Now, according to Nine, Airbnb bookings have been decimated in popular Australian locations, threatening to send over-leveraged investors who made a lucrative living from the platform into financial peril. The seismic shock that hit Airbnb will reverberate through the wider Australian property market. Some market experts predict, spelling good news for residential renters who have been pushed out from areas like Bondi, Byron Bay, and inner city pockets in Sydney and Melbourne. The flip side is Airbnb super landlords and mum and dad investors who now find themselves overexposed and facing savage cuts to their expected rental income. New data obtained by 9.com.au has revealed Australian landlords have been hit by precipitous drops in bookings and revenues of more than 70% in Sydney and Melbourne during April, when domestic and international tourism stopped. Brisbane and the Gold Coast have also been badly affected. This is a real problem, my housing market chief economist Dr. Andrew Wilson said. Dr. Wilson said many Australians had taken advantage of higher rentals and become enterprise Airbnb landlords in what had evolved into a very lucrative venture in recent years. It's a question of how those Airbnb landlords survived this, he said. There has been a steep decline in weekly Airbnb revenues across all Australian locations, according to AirDNA, a website that tracks the Airbnb economy. Comparing March the 1st to the end of April, Melbourne was down 75%, Sydney 71% down, Gold Coast was 57% lower, and Brisbane was 54% down. A similar trend was reflected in weekly Airbnb reservations for the same period. Bookings in Melbourne dropped by 72%, Sydney by 70%, Brisbane by 67%, and the Gold Coast by 51%. Chris Pettit, a professor of urban science at University of New South Wales City Future Research Centre, said the sudden Airbnb downturn would likely impact Australia's broader property investment market. Professor Pettit said the 200,000 Australian listings on Airbnb equated to roughly 4% of the nation's total housing market. He said UNSW research indicated that around 80% of the 200,000 Australian listings were investment properties, not traditional holiday lettings. That is about 6 to 8% of Australia's total investment market, which is a fairly reasonable exposure. Professor Pettit predicted upper to middle class investors with liquidity would probably fare okay and ride out the storm, but those who have leverage significantly might face some issues and struggle, he said. According to Inside Airbnb, another website that tracks the platform, there are five landlords in Sydney who manage more than 100 listings, and many Australians are linked to dozens and dozens of Airbnb individual listings. There will definitely be people who have Airbnb properties as a significant component of their investment portfolio and who are going to be exposed and hurting significantly, Professor Pettit said. Some will look at switching their property to long-term rentals, but the return will be a lot less. They could expect rental returns down 30 to 50%. He said the shift from short-term Airbnb lets to regular residential was good news for livability in places like Bondi, Byron Bay, Hobart and the CBDs of Melbourne and Sydney. And Professor Pettit said long-term residents had been pushed out of popular Australian neighbourhoods by landlords chasing bigger returns in the Airbnb game. Dr. Wilson said the property market had been softening already before the coronavirus and rental prices would likely drop further in the coming months. What looked like a nice little side earner for those who bought apartments to convert into Airbnb investments is just gone and it's finished, he said, with international tourism likely on hold for years. Dr. Wilson predicted Airbnb bookings to remain subdued, if not empty, for some time. A few months ago, Airbnb was valued at $48 billion and heading for a bumper IPO this year, but the upstart disruptor of the hotel industry has been disrupted by the coronavirus, and the hotly anticipated IPO may not happen in 2020. With the travel industry smashed, Airbnb laid off 25% of its workforce earlier this month. In a letter to employees, Chief Executive Brian Chesky wrote, "We are collectively living through the most harrowing crisis of our lifetime." Airbnb's Australian country manager, Susan Wheeldon, told 9.com.au, "The travel is resilient in the long term and will ultimately recover." International tourism expected to make up around 30% of Australia's total sector. We're definitely seeing a strong resurgence in people planning trips for later in the year, she said. And Ms. Walden said Airbnb had not seen a material drop in the overall number of listings. In an attempt to shore up the Airbnb economy, the San Francisco tech giant in March set up a $250 million US emergency fund for hosts and $70 million US dollars for superhosts. And UBS has looked at the latest JobKeeper data, which of course was revised materially down from 6.5 million to 3.5 million, or a $60 billion spending save. Australian authorities found reported errors, which saw the number of people on JobKeeper revised materially down from 6.5 million to 2.9 million. The expected peak was also cut sharply from 6 million to 3.5 million, reducing the fiscal cost by $60 billion, from 130 billion to 70 billion. This means our estimate of total government fiscal support, including states, is also significantly lower, albeit still totaling $164 billion, or 8.7% of GDP. The forecast missed was largely because of an assumed six-month hibernation, but fewer COVID cases saw a quicker reopening of the economy. Less bad labour markets means we upgrade consumption and GDP forecasts, they said. The JobKeeper revisions is undoubtedly positive economic news because the labour market and the budget are much less weak than previously thought. This also confirms the surprising stabilisation of payrolls and wages, which saw us upgrade our household cash flow model to positive quarter over quarter across quarter two and quarter three, with upside risk to spending and a rebound of sentiment. Recent channel checks indicate materially better even positive card spending, albeit this likely overstates total consumption given the near halting of cash payments, which amounts for around 10% of spending. Importantly, UBS Consumer Survey indicates a surprisingly strong willingness to spend via less saving and more debt. And overall, while April retail and car sales had record collapses, early signs of improvement leads us to upgrade our forecast for the quarter two consumption to a 7% drop over the quarter, and this is less of an upgrade than implied by the JobKeeper revision, because since March they'd already assumed, optimistically at the time, a reopening of the economy in the late second quarter. That said, they are now even more positive that the Australian Treasury and RBA forecast of around 15% quarter over quarter for GDP, and quarter two is also revised up to down 7.5%, which was 10% previously. With 2020 now less bad at down 5.2% year over year, compared with 6.1% down previously, but with 2021 recovering less sharply to up 4.6% compared with 5.2%. Household cash flow still faces a quarter four cliff, but there is now more room for a policy response. They said the JobKeeper revision doesn't remove the still very likely large negative quarter over quarter for household cash flow in the fourth quarter. On current settings, around $100 billion or 20% of quarterly GDP of policy support will end in the third quarter. And this includes $3.5 million on JobKeeper, which they assume will see almost no net job losses, keeping the quarter fourth consumption flat. Second, 1.6 million on JobSeeker facing temporarily increased benefits that stop. And third, around 20 billion of early superannuation withdrawals that won't be repeated. And fourth, deferrals of around $225 billion of debt repayments will cease, albeit some may be converted to interest only, while deferred rent is net neutral. While there is now much more fiscal policy flexibility to phase out the stimulus and reduce the size of this cliff, i.e. less chance of a W-shaped recovery, the PM's comments indicate that government is unlikely to extend or expand the policies outside ongoing support to some specific industries, especially tourism. However, there seems a rising chance of new direct policy support for housing, such as a first home owner grant, albeit they've already assumed this will be required and forthcoming to drive their expectation of a rebound of dwelling commencements from around 130,000 in 2020, compared with 120 previously, to 170,000 in 2021, and limit the decline of housing prices to around 10%. They are assuming the total government deficit will be around $254 billion in 2021, and the debt will lift to around $440 billion, which is 75% of GDP. And the Australian government will give an update on June the 12th, and they expect the total government sector budget to end up with a deficit in 1920 of $144 billion, of which the closely followed Commonwealth General Government is $59 billion, or 7.6% of GDP in 2021. The total deficit is $254 billion, and that's 13.5% of GDP. And so they're now projecting the total government debt, including states and other, to lift sharply between 2019 and 2021 by around $440 billion compared to $500 billion previously, and to reach $1.4 trillion, or 75% of GDP. Construction fell again in the latest ABS figures. Total construction in trend terms fell 1.4% in the March quarter 2020. Building works done fell 1.4% in March, with non-residential building work done up 0.7% and residential building work down 2.9%. The seasonally adjusted estimate of total building works fell 1% to $28.9 billion in the March quarter, and engineering work done fell 1.3% in the March quarter in trend terms, and seasonally adjusted estimates for engineering work fell 1.1% to $20.5 billion in the March quarter. Construction work done in New South Wales has fallen for six quarters, whereas construction work done in Victoria has risen for three quarters. Construction work done in Queensland has fallen for eight quarters, whereas construction work done in Western Australia has fallen for one quarter. And construction work done in South Australia has fallen for seven quarters, whereas construction work done in the Northern Territories has fallen for 10 quarters. And then construction work in Tasmania has fallen for two quarters. Construction work done in the ACT has risen for two quarters. In a quarter that largely preceded the COVID-19 disruption, residential building activity chalked up the sixth consecutive quarterly contraction in the volume of building work done. The persistent credit squeeze through 2019 contributed to home building activity dropping back to levels last seen in 2014, said Tim Reardon, the HIA chief economist. The value of work done on new homes in March 2020 is now down by 10% against the level a year ago, and the value of work done on multi-unit dwellings is now down by 20% over the year. The residential building industry had already experienced a significant downturn before COVID-19 struck. Leading indicators of home building deteriorated markedly in April and May, which paves the way for activity to fall further as the year progresses, he said. Today's data confirms that the decline in home buildings will detract from GDP growth in the March quarter of this year, and the drag from falling home building activity will become more significant in the June quarter. We remain concerned for the millions of workers in the industry and the subsequent adverse impact on the wider economy. A credit squeeze led to the contraction in home building throughout 2019, but it must not hinder home building as the economy responds to the COVID-19 crisis. Regulators have encouraged banks to facilitate the ongoing supply of credit to the Australian economy, but this is not happening for home building. Since the onset of COVID-19, the extra layers of checks and balances that lenders introduce have created additional hurdles, he said. These newly created bottlenecks in the system are preventing builders from being paid for work they've completed. And payments that once occurred within 7 days are now taking up to 4 weeks. We must see banks doing a better job facilitating residential building activity, concluded Mr. Reardon. No surprise there, considering that the construction lobby are pushing the government for more support for first-time buyers and a whole lot more. And Banking Day highlighted that the demand for guarantees under the Morrison government's first home loan deposit scheme now exceeds capacity after the limit of 10,000 borrower reservations was reached last week. Data collated by the National Housing Finance and Investment Corporation, which is the government agency tasked with managing the program, shows that 5,500 guarantees have been issued through the scheme, and another 4,500 borrowers have guarantees reserved for residential property purchases in the coming months. The COVID-19 health crisis and the resulting lockdown of economic activity could be one of the drivers of heavy borrower demand for the government guarantees. The pandemic's profound impact on the tourism, hospitality, entertainment, and fitness industries prompted QBE to impose a temporary embargo on the provision of lenders' mortgage insurance to borrowers employed in these sectors. QBE's embargo meant that scores of lenders stopped taking applications from low-deposit first-home buyers working in those industries, and the decision forced mortgage brokers to identify other lending options for prospective low-deposit home buyers, including the First Home Loan Deposit Scheme, which is backed by CBA, NAB and 25 other lenders. First-home buyers are eligible to secure a government guarantee even if they only have a 5% deposit on a home loan. And the main benefit of the guarantee is that young borrowers are not required to cover the cost of LMI on their loans. But of course, they also only have a 5% buffer should prices fall. And finally, Fitch Ratings has made further cuts in their world GDP forecasts in its latest global economic outlook. But the slump in economic activity is close to reaching its trough, they say. World GDP is now forecast to fall by 4.6% in 2020, compared to a decline of 3.9% predicted in the late April update. This reflects downward revisions in the Eurozone and the UK, and most significantly to emerging markets excluding China. Fitch now expects Eurozone GDP to fall by 8.2% in 2020, compared to a contraction of 7% in the previous estimate. This reflects incoming data that points to larger than anticipated falls in activity in France, Italy, and Spain amid lockdowns that were more stringent than those in some other countries. They now expect the GDP of Spain to fall by 9.6% and by 9.5% in Italy, and by 9% in France. And the lockdown in the UK also looks set to last longer than previously assumed, with a sharp fall in GDP published by the Office of National Statistics for March. They now expect the economy to contract by 7.8% compared with a 6.3% forecast previously. They expect output in emerging markets, excluding China, to fall by 4.5% this year, compared to a predicted fall of 1.9% before. And the large revision reflects the deterioration in the health crisis in many of the largest emerging markets over the past month or so, including in Brazil, India, and Russia. And the biggest forecast cut was to India, where they now anticipate a 5% decline in the current financial year, ending March 2021, in contrast to an earlier forecast of growth of 0.8%. India's had a very stringent lockdown policy that has lasted a lot longer than was initially expected, and incoming economic activity data has been spectacularly weak. Infections accelerated sharply in Brazil and Russia from mid-April, and they now see GDP falling by 6% in Brazil and by 5% in Russia. Forecasts for 2020 GDP growth for China, the US and Japan are unchanged since late April at 0.7, minus 5.6 and minus 5% respectively. And they're also affirming forecasts for Australia, Korea and South Africa. So the assessment of global economic prospects are starting to stabilise following a succession of downward forecast revisions in recent updates. And they say this concurs with other evidence that the collapse in global economic activity may be close to bottoming out. A number of early monthly economic indicators for May have improved slightly on their April values, and daily mobility data shows consumers' visits to retail and recreation venues have increased in the Eurozone and in the US since lockdown started to be eased in late April and early May. The weekly US growth tracker has edged up slightly in the past 2 weeks and is consistent with an earlier forecast of a 10% year-on-year decline in 2020. These are all tentative signs, they say, but China's recent experience suggests that activity will rise after lockdowns are eased. Industrial production is now back to December 2019 levels, and fixed asset investment and credit growth are rising. Moreover, global macroeconomic policy stimulus has been increased further over the past month or so, beyond the already huge commitments made. The US has announced an additional fiscal package valued at more than 2% of GDP, with more being discussed. Italy unveiled a second wave of easing measures. The UK extended its jobs subsidy scheme, and Fitch now expects China's general government fiscal deficit to widen to 11.2% in 2020 from 4.9% in 2019. And they predict that global quantitative easing will reach $6 trillion US dollars in 2020, equivalent to half of the cumulative QE purchases by the Fed, ECB, Bank of England, and Bank of Japan combined in 2009 to 2018. This explosion in central bank liquidity has helped to secure a pickup in bank credit to the real economy, specifically to firms, in the past couple of months, they said, a development that contrasts with the patterns in 2009. Nevertheless, the return to economic normality is likely to be a slow and bumpy process. The rupture in the labour market, with US unemployment now expected to peak at 20% in May, and ongoing social distancing will weigh heavily on consumer spending post-crisis, while firms will be very cautious on capital spending. We foresee a technical pickup in global GDP growth to 5.1% in 2021, with US and Eurozone output rising by around 4%, but pre-virus levels of GDP are unlikely to be reached until mid-2022 in the US and significantly later in Europe. This is despite massive policy stimulus. An aggressive resurgence of the virus that necessitated greatly extended or renewed nationwide lockdowns would lead to an even worse outcome. And their downside scenario sees GDP falling by 12% in the US and Europe in 2020, and global GDP down by more than 9%. So it seems to me that whilst the stock markets are in up mode, they are somewhat disconnected from the real economy, where consumer sentiment and construction activity is pretty weak, and even the GDP forecasts are also on the low side. Perhaps we will see a faster pickup, but so far the signs suggest more weight on the brake than on the accelerator. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.